One question which I received by a little paper note was if I could talk a little bit about this finger of the old lady pointing to the moon. So, just to say it in different words, this the basic idea is when the old lady says, look at the moon, then every one of us, we will not look at the finger, although she is pointing with the finger. We will follow the indication of the finger, and then over there, we will see the moon. So the same is with the words. When I was teaching now, I'm using words, but these are finger pointers. These are pointers to something. You have to kind of follow the trajectory. You have to follow that direction, and then behind the words, you find what is being meant. But this is, you have to look for yourself. And maybe in the example, why old lady? Because it's not, you know, it's not even a straight finger where you can say it's pointing exactly to the center of the moon. Actually, it's a very relaxed pointing, and it points just about in the direction, but not exactly. There's not even an intention on the one, in the mind of the one pointing to make it absolutely exact and precise, because there is a knowledge that it is anyhow by your own intuitive perception that you will know. So that's the meaning of this example, just to say it maybe a little bit more precisely. Any other questions? Yes, please. Mm-hmm. Yes, the question is, in the Dzogchen paths that are pointing out instruction, is it the same in Mahamudra? And yes, that are pointing out instructions in Mahamudra. Now, there is the possibility that when practitioners have really done the preliminaries, have prepared themselves, then once they are ready, not before they have completed really a long time of practice of Guru Yoga, then the Lama calls them and gives the pointing out instructions. Now, this is not what we will do here. We would have to wait quite a while before the situation is ready. So the pointing out instructions, they happen in between. They happen spontaneously. And if you're ready, you will get them. But yes, indeed, my teacher was this one here, Kendo Rinpoche. He was not giving any teaching without some pointing out instructions somewhere. And those who were in a kind of meditative state or very receptive, then that would work. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I understand you. I repeat your question as good as I can. I will do this every time for the recording, and that you understand in the back of the room. So you are a little bit, you feel less grounding because you're used to this Goenka style, very clear, precise instructions. And here we talk about the nature of mind and about this and that, and it's all very much floating. And I can sympathize with that. And I can't even promise that I will become so much more specific. I will try. I've been brought up in that tradition as well, as I mentioned. It's just the colleague of Goenka with Mother Sayama and Huchitin I was practicing. So, yes, we do have a lot of precise instructions in the Mahamudra instructions, and I will share some with you. I also felt it's the time now that I've kind of set the frame and I've made you float a little bit, you know, and I know that is uncomfortable because I have not been precise, like do this, do that, and so on, not like this. But I will give you more hints of how to actually use your mind. And then when the mind frame is set, when the basic understanding of refuge is there, of bodhicitta, about the nature of mind, when the view and the attitude are established, then it makes sense to give more energy into the precise practices, like, for example, walking meditation or awareness of breathing, you know, because then all these precise exercises, they will find an inspiration with the new kind of view and attitude. So I needed to be making you a little bit, you know, loosening up from this kind of feeling, this is how it has to be, but go into a very intuitive field, and then within that we can come to very precise instructions. So I'm sorry for that discomfort. I will do my best for those who can stay for the week, then definitely you will get a taste of precise instructions. In a weekend, it is typical that we first need to talk about the view and the attitude, especially when I come into a completely unprepared context where most of you have never heard of Mahamudra. In a normal teaching situation, to introduce Mahamudra in a weekend, there would be at least 6 hours of teaching every day, 12 hours altogether minimum, plus the practice and so on. So we are adapting to that, what is possible here and what is your normal surrounding. And my wish is that you do not hesitate to fall back to use the practices that you have learned here, because they are fine. You use these practices that you are familiar with, and with the time, you will add a little different way of doing it. There will be a slight change in the way you apply those instructions. Just to give you an example, we have in the Vipassana, we have this very precise, close-on following of all the mental movements. And we go to a very rapid, very, very precise, rapid, clear presence, noticing all the movements. Now, this, yes, is possible. You experience that also in the Mahamudra. But the focus will be one on not noticing the movements, but noticing how everything dissolves by itself in that spaciousness. So there's not the idea that one has to follow very closely, but as immediately as they arise, they dissolve and already give space to the next experience. So in the Mahamudra view, we don't talk about moments of experience. There are no moments. No one can find a moment. There's only this ongoing experience. So there's no talking about being precise one moment to the next and so on. It's always this in the continuity of the experience, yeah, in the continuity of the ever-changing now. And so this is why there will be changes, but you can continue all the time with what you have learned. It's absolutely helpful. My advice to Mahamudra practitioners is go and do several of those Goenka courses. Go and do really down-to-earth Vipassana courses. This is where you learn how to sit, you know, and you learn the basics. And so don't fly off in, you know, Mahamudra cloud number 9, whatever you call it. Yes, stay on earth, watch your breath, watch how you walk, you know, do all of that. That's very, very important. I hope I answered a little bit your question. Yes? Please. Yes, I noticed that. Yes. What he is saying, just to everybody, am I allowed to repeat what you are saying? Yes, you were feeling like very activated ADHD, so hyperactivity syndrome, and I started talking and your mind went off and you weren't here during the rest of the talk. I noticed that also during the meditations. So how can we connect? How is that possible? Do you have some advice for me or a suggestion? It's okay. I know this phenomena happens. There are different possible explanations for that. Now, that's why I need to know you a little bit more, because I would hesitate to give any of those explanations without knowing you. I just observed that because you're sitting in my field of vision. So I was very much aware of that. What is most interesting to you? Why did you come here to this course? Maybe I can more answer your wish that brought you here. Okay, welcome. I give you another 2 days. Good. We have a rendezvous? Okay, good. Please.
First, I want to thank you for coming all the way to Utah and finding offering your teaching. I wanted to ask about the perception and the self. You were talking about no clinging to a perceived self, but also you mentioned that each one of us has their experience, their imprint, their life experience. And I'm just curious to hear more about
Are you yourself also a therapist, psychologist, or something like that? Or no, but you're interested in that. Okay. To repeat the question, if I could talk more about the self, the seeming self, and at the same time I talk about these experiences, character, personalities, and so on. How does this fit together also for my understanding as a therapist? Okay. Basically, the first thing one has to say when nowadays modern psychotherapy or psychology talks about a self, they don't talk about a solid self anymore. This is out. Since 30, 40 years, no one talks about a solid self, but about a dynamic self. Yeah? It's a dynamic, learning self, always changing, capable to adapt to situations. So this is all the development of Sigmund Freud's first talking about, you know, the self in the sense of I, the S, the it, and the superego, yeah, the über ich. Then from that onwards, with Anna Freud, with his daughter, and with other further psychotherapists, they went into a description of self as being a sum total of capacities to love, to enter into interaction, to make sense of situations, to master challenges, to, you know, and they were defining the capacities of what is called a sound self, ein gesundes Ich, yeah? a sound I, we say Ich in German language. And this, what they described as a sound self, actually this Ich-Psychologie, the psychology of the self, finishes up with 8 stages of development from a very narrow perspective of self, very ego-centered, to an always more integrated sense of self, always more capable to take in different views and increase sense of flexibility without ever losing ground. And this modern definition of what is a self in psychotherapy, this is now shared by all the other approaches. This is not something which is discussed. This is actually describing the way of Dharma practice. It is actually a gradual loosening of a narrow sense of self to an integrated personality. I wrote a whole chapter about that in my book on Buddhist psychotherapy, psychology. It is actually a way of describing also how narrow-mindedness disappears with the capacity of integration getting more and more, the fluidity of mind, a deep emotional stability, and then, of course, the path of awakening continues further even than that. From that perspective, you would say a Buddha, a completely awakened being, has the most sound and stable ego of everybody because of not clinging to a self. That's why there is this stability and this capacity of integration, this capacity to love, this even the, you know, even to the point of unconditional love. So these are all signs of an incredible development of the self. And some people, and also some Buddhist strands and tantra, like they call it the true self. They use this term, which is out in the normal Theravadin approach. You would never talk about the true self, but in tantra you do, and you. It's like Ramana Maharshi, you know. It's a Advaita Vedanta. There you also talk about the true self, but it is not individual. It is not personal. It is universal. And we talk about these universal qualities as manifesting due to the realization of the non-self of the small, narrow soul, you can say, the limited aspect of our projections. So I hope to help you with that. That what we call non-self, anatta, anatman in the Buddhist tradition, is actually the best possible way of developing that what others would call a true self or a sound self. Yes. This is my understanding of it, because none of these awakened masters have difficulties in saying I and you and I will be there tomorrow, I will come and visit you next year. All the relative interactive capacities of self and others, they are fully there and they are highly developed. So this is that we are not losing that capacity to communicate in the world with self and others. Actually, we are gaining more and more flexibility. Okay, this needs to be as short as that. There would be much more to say. Okay. I look back there. Yes, please. I saw one hand rising. Yes. Interesting, yes, huh? Interesting. There are these people who say that nirvana, once you reach it, you leave, and that's it, you don't come back again. And that is the idea. And then, what did the Buddha do after his nirvana? He stayed around. Okay. And seemingly himself talked a lot about lifetime after lifetime coming back with developing these paramitas, these paramis, and more and more. And this is the coming back, although there is already an experience of awakening. It's an interesting perspective, and that's why the Buddhists have developed this notion of parinirvana, which is more definite than the nirvana. But, you know, these are words. Basically, it is like this, I would say, that the initial experiences of awakening, like probably you are familiar with like Sotapanna, stream enterer, and then, yeah, like these. No, you're not? Oh, okay, then I use different terminology. So when there is a first strong experience of awakening, already then, you know, this is a very surprising moment, and you can't really describe it, but afterwards you feel that there's a change of perspective. And for some people, this transformation is longer lasting, and others, they fall back quickly into clinging again. It was nevertheless an authentic experience, but the power of transformation is usually not such that it has, with just one experience of awakening, that it is a definite nirvana in which you could abide. I mean, 99.9% of practitioners, it's definitely not that. It is an experience, you fall back in your patterns, but you don't believe your own patterns. There is not that belief in one's own projections as it was before. They're weaker. And even if you get angry, you don't believe your own anger as much anymore. If you're full of desire, you don't believe your own desire anymore. Your pride becomes hollow. You know, it's like, and then when you continue practice, you make these experiences again and again, and it becomes more stable. Their transformative power increases, and this is what we call a gradual path. The experience of nirvana, because that is undoubtedly an experience of true awakening, but it's not stable. And that's why there's a coming back, and then it has to stabilize sufficiently before you take the risk of another rebirth. Because if it's not sufficiently stable in this life, you better don't take the risk to come back. Yes, you have to be able to contact that easily, on your own, if possible, without the help of many teachers who point out and help you to get there. So that is the reason why bodhisattvas, in order to come back, they should develop, actually, in this life, already a reliable realization. So their experience of nirvana has to be reliable enough to risk coming back. And in those approaches, those teachers will say, better take care to get out of here, yeah, out of this samsara, then they are more realistic, because they estimate fully well the great danger of kind of interacting with other mind streams, with full of emotions and projections, and getting caught yourself again if you're not stable. This much for now. I see two. Please look who of you will talk first. There was a word, do you have a goal to reach nirvana? Very good question. No. Because I trust it's already there. Is that okay? Are you okay with that answer? Okay. Now, this has stopped. I'm not going for a nirvana anymore. I was once very motivated, yes. Yes, I might have misunderstood you because of the distance. Our question is if in the Mahamudra we also pay a lot of attention to the breath, was to the body, to the emotions, because second part was sensations. And was the second part of the questions on emotions? No, only sensations. Changing sensations in the body. Yes, you see, in the Goenka style approach, then you spend lots of time, you know, going through the body, meditating on all the sensations, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Yeah, you go through many times. And this was actually the main point of the practice. And we do that as well, but not as much. And why I had difficulties to understand you is that we would, this is again, how can I explain that? It's a similarity and a difference. If you remember the deeper instructions in the Goenka retreats, in these Vipassana retreats, then whenever the sensation arises, you are asked to remember that it is anicca, that it is impermanent, yes, that it is changing. You are asked to arise that clinging to any of these changing sensations is dukkha, and that any form of identifying with it will create more dukkha. And due to that, you're being asked or you're being encouraged to see that there is no self in this whole process of sensations arising and disappearing. Now, up to there, it's pretty much the same approach, we would say in the Mahamudra. And then we would say, stop labeling. We would ask the practitioner to stop saying anicca, dukkha, anatta, to use any forms of labels, to go into a direct perception of, first of all, the sensations, so physical sensations, directly entering as much as possible the burning sensation, the vibration, everywhere, going into where it is the strongest, to see whether we can find a center. And then the next instruction would be go into the perceiver, go into the person meditating. That would be you. You trying to do well, to follow these instructions. Who is trying to perceive the sensations? We would go with our awareness, we would try to find where is the greatest density of that feeling that I meditate. And it's exactly there where we go with our awareness. And again, we can't find someone. So we purposely go into the illusion of the subject and the illusion of the object. And we investigate the empty nature of the one meditating, the one being so inspired to reach nirvana. You know, we try to find that one. And we try to find if there is anything in the outer world, in the world of experiences or sensations, which has any substance. And in this way, the anatta, the non-self of the person, the subject, and the anatta, the shunyata, the empty nature of all the sensations, of all the experiences, is realized. That would be the approach in Mahamudra. Want to follow up your question? Did these words reach you? You create some understanding, or yeah? Okay. It's different, right? Yes, then you get it. If you see that there is really a difference, yes. But it helped me a lot to have done these years of practice in the Saya Ubakin tradition. Yeah? Helped me a lot. And it's always a good basis on which I fall back in case I need. Yes, now it's your turn. I didn't use the term, but what I described as Tantra Mahamudra, this is the Vajrayana. So it is, Vajrayana is based on these visions, uses mantras, uses visualizations, and so on. So that's what we call Vajrayana, sometimes translated as the diamond way. But actually, Vajrayana, yana means the vehicle or the path, and Vajra is not a diamond. It means the indestructible nature of mind. It is pointing to that primordial, timeless awareness that is always there, completely reliable. It points to this ultimate refuge. So Vajrayana is the tantric Buddhist approach. Yes. Want to follow up the question? Or that's okay? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, you too? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then you spoke about things that disturb us while we are meditating. You spoke about being too tired or too quiet. And you said just find focus on your interest. It doesn't take an effort to focus.
The question is, I was talking about effortless meditation, and then when it was about these two obstacles to meditation, the restlessness, agitation, and the dullness, sleepiness, then I told you something about making the right effort, you know, tensing a little bit. I didn't say focus the interest, work with the interest. So is the question is that interest without effort? Just look at your kids. Effortlessly, five hours. You know, whatever gadget they have, they can spend endless time playing with them. The interest is so great that somehow they don't seem to get tired. Well, that's maybe a bad example because it's it's an example where interest is motivated by desire. So it doesn't lead out of samsara. It doesn't lead to a deep realization. No one has gotten awakened, huh? With the tablet or whatever, yes? With a joystick and so on, whatever. So the art of developing a relaxed interest that does not create an artificial, unnecessary effort is really something we need to learn. I'm not saying that it is easy. Normally, the moment we are interested, it is like we make the body makes this movement, and the mind makes the same movement. It tenses a little bit. It goes into a direction. Now, but we can learn to relax and to be interested. For example, I'm really interested what happens in the right, you know, you see it's just moving a little bit, you know? I'm interested to see what is happening in the right corner of my eyes. And I stay really relaxed, but very attentive. So although you were really at the very edge of visual perception, the field of perception was so large, my mind was relaxed, and fortunately enough, it was just moving. So it was possible to perceive that. And somehow it is this relaxed interest that we learn in order not to go the path with a lot of willpower and then producing samsara again, but an inspiration, a joy. This is why joy is so important in the practice, because it creates this natural interest. Compassion, love, they are these, if they become the motivating forces instead of wanting to reach a goal oneself, then the practice becomes easy. So there would be a lot to say about the art of finding that motivation that is not immediately leading to a narrowing of one's attention, one's mind, yeah? And that's, I want to communicate that to you, but of course it's not so easy. Yeah. Second one, yes.
It's about trust.
Mm-hmm.
I try and understand it, and I try to be right, and I'm sorry, I put it like that, but on the 7th of October, I was trustful, and cognitively I understand and told me, you know, you trust too much or something, you know.
You're talking about an experience shared by many people in the world. And there are many 7th Octobers happening in this world, and millions of people on all sides have lost trust everywhere. Yes, and this is maybe the greatest damage that has happened, that it is yet more difficult. Also, with the reaction, you know, the bombarding which has happened since then, there is more and more people losing trust all over the world. Not even those who are bombarded and who are doing the bombarding, everywhere, you know, not only those who were in the kibbutz seems, which were, you know, where all of that happened. But we have this phenomenon, and you know that it's going on all over the world, unfortunately. Now, may I take your question further? You were living by the trust, and you probably look for a way to find a more realistic trust, or to live by the trust again on a new level of understanding, or?
I ask your advice because I do live in trust, even though the 7th of October exists. But I found it hard to my body did not accept. I tried to understand and care
I get you better now. The question is, she wants to understand the gap between the mind and the body, because the body showed the signs of losing the trust and shock maybe, and yes, and the mind still feels, yes, there is the possibility of trust. And the body usually is a perfect mirror of what has happened unconsciously, subconsciously to us. The body cannot lie. Yes? The mind can make its own scenarios, and one can continue with a way of seeing and believing and so on, but the body shows signs of stress, deep stress. And now we are talking of stress all over the world. Persecutors persecuted everywhere in the world. Yes? We talk about individuals, we talk about groups of people, we talk about nations, we talk really everywhere in the world. This is now happening, and it has happened. And the body shows the signs. And although you try to lighten up your mind, the body is exhausted. It has signs of stress and cannot sleep and is maybe has lost appetite or whatever, pains everywhere and so on. Yes? So the way to deal with that has to go through a combined approach of body and mind. Yes? We have to take that into account. And it takes a very deep, honest approach. What you're describing is that you lived a traumatism. Yeah, this is called a trauma. And it is that the body still reacts. And we know this from people who have been attacked or who have been in war as soldiers and who have had the bombs on their heads and so on, or have just heard about it. Some people are traumatized by just seeing things on the screen. You know, one doesn't have to have personally been there in order to feel the shock. So we are all participating in that. And it's my sincere wish that I could talk to Palestinians, that I would share the Dharma with them as well. It's my sincerest wish There's no taking of sides, even if I don't know how to use the examples in this audience, because every example is like full with potential trauma, re-traumatization, and so on. So I try to open up this perspective, but the healing process needs a safe surrounding, and it needs a new integration of what one has lived, not negating it, like you say, it has happened, but it is continuing to happen. It is continuing all the time now. It doesn't stop in the world. And you know, just to give you a different example, just to change your perspective. When there was this invasion in Tibet, monks were forced with guns pointed at them to violate nuns or to shoot their sisters and brothers of the monastery. And many preferred to kill themselves instead of doing it. But atrocities have happened all over the world, and they are happening all the time. Now, when I teach, for me, I teach in the awareness that this is ongoing and that we can be lucky to have periods of peace. We can be very lucky. Now, here in the Middle East, you have not had long periods of peace. The solution is kind of there, but no one is accepting the solutions, the possible ones. Very difficult. In that central part of Europe where I come from, these, 75 years of peace that we have had, have never happened before. It hasn't happened before that, for example, Germany hasn't had war for such a long period. And this tells me something about samsara. It tells me something about the way this world works. Ongoing strife. Everyone struggling for one's own well-being. Groups getting together, interest groups, you know, clans, and so on. Nations, ethnics, and always the same self-interest. So the trust we are talking about, the trust comes from experiencing the refuge, experiencing that safe place in ourselves, which is, you can say, our home, that dimension of being that will accompany us even beyond leaving this body. The only way to really get out of that stress that everyone is experiencing here, everyone, no matter which ethnic group, which religious group, everyone is experiencing that stress. Basically, it has to do with a fear of annihilation, a fear of death. It has to do with the fear of losing all one's values, of losing to first to fear, then of losing to anger, then of losing to self-protection, all the things we don't want. They all knock on the door. All these emotions, they knock on the door. And the fear is very much to get lost, to exactly that which I don't want, either to be killed, to be injured, to lose one's very close ones, one's friends, one's relatives, and to lose finally all confidence, all trust in the good side of human beings. And it's the worst that can happen to us. So for some people, it's worse than dying. If I could die with the trusting the wonderful human potential. So the way of healing is actually a very deep one, that we need to work on all these fears, basically overcoming the fear to die, basically touching in this wonderful source of qualities in us to see that they have not gone lost, no matter how strong the shock, how strong the trauma, they are still there. They're here right now. They're here in the room, in everybody, and to find ways to relax into that again and again. In psychotherapy, we call this working with the resources. The deepest resources of human mind is the nature of mind. And that is from where the deepest healing can come. From that state or that dimension of being which is beyond all these hopes and fears. So to some extent, our goodness, our belief in the good side of humanity was based on unrealistic assumptions, on an unrealistic way of seeing humankind. My father, who was one of the soldiers, but also the victims of the war, he took us as children. He wanted us to see the concentration camps. He came 12 times to Israel. He brought students here. He wanted us to go to Morocco, Algeria, and so on. He, you know, go everywhere in the world to contact the different traditions and religions so that never such atrocities as in his time could happen again. This was an eye-opener for me early on. So I grew up with a constant awareness of what atrocities had happened in the lifetime of both of my parents. And it helped me then again to meet that in the life story of our Tibetan teachers who had lived such atrocities, they crossed the Himalayas, others couldn't. They had to leave behind their home. And then it was very comforting to me, in a strange way, to read that at the time of Buddha, of Gautama Buddha, that he had to witness the annihilation of the whole Shakya clan. You know, he was the son of the regent of the Shakyas. He could avoid several wars because five Maharajas were his students. So when they started to fight with each other and with another one, sometimes he would appear in the right time and was able to avoid those wars. But he tried to avoid the war which destroyed his whole home. 70,000 Shakyas were killed in that time. And he lived it. He lived through that catastrophe. They were all murdered by the neighboring clan. No way to avoid it. Even a Buddha couldn't avoid it. And he tried. So reading that and knowing that the Dharma that we practice does not come from a naive belief in the goodness of people just because we want to believe it. No, it comes from a very clear estimation that we are maybe the most cruel being on this planet and at the same time have a potential for being so fantastic, so caring, so loving, far beyond our bonds of blood and beliefs and ethnics and so on. We have an incredible capacity to grow beyond our normal limitations. And this is the twofold view of the human being, which is very typical for the Buddhist way of looking at the world. No naive beliefs about what humans can do or cannot do. Everything is possible there. No limits. And then seeing that this is not the truth by itself. There is a deeper truth which only reveals when you open up, when you relax. When you open up into that dimension which gives the real trust. So whichever horizons we come from, we have no other choice. We have to go into that dimension, which the Buddha called the deathless state. That state which is free from hope and fear. And we learn to become familiar with that, and then not only trust arises, but a certainty arises. has a certainty that it is like this. It's not a belief anymore. You can see it. You can feel it. You can see the people changing. Yes. And this is wonderful. This is so great. It's never impossible, but you don't know when it will happen. Yes. You had a question. Is it still appropriate? Another day. Good. What day is today? she's pulling the clock. You know, huh? Yes, I'm not supposed to be the precise one. If I do it the Mahamudra style, you never know when it finishes. I tell you a story, since we have time, huh? I tell you a story. You know about this crazy Kaji Lama, same tradition as myself, called Trungpa Rinpoche. He was outrageous as well, living in the United States. Now, he would do these datuns. Da means dava, means moon, means 1 month, and tun means session. So, one retreat, 1 month. And when Trungpa Rinpoche was improvisible, when he wanted to teach, then the gong would ring and everyone would have to appear in the meditation hall. We're talking about 200, 300 people doing the retreat together. I know the story from people who were there, yes? One of my closest friends was a very close student of Trungpa. And then, just to tell you how Mahamudra teacher could be, in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, the gong goes on. The gong goes, everyone wakes up. Oh, he wants to teach. Rushing down to the meditation hall. Wait, wait. Then after 3/4 of an hour, Trungpa comes in, sits down and said, practice. Then he leaves. You know, it could be as crazy as that. With my own teacher, the teachings would go hardly ever be below 3 hours on a stretch without a pause. But we never had teachings really which were less than 3 hours. And he wouldn't leave us before all questions were finished. So here to say, it's time, questions have to wait, this didn't exist. He would just stay. And this is why Gendun Rinpoche, when he died, when he passed away, I felt for many years, for about 7 years, I felt like that I had no questions. I have asked everything. We were about meditation, about ethics, about activity. It took a long time before I felt, oh, this would be something I would love to talk with him about. And it is this plenitude of, this is what we call a transmission. You know, this is in the good old days, you live together and you spend hours without end and practice and ask, hear the teachings, and so on. And then you feel, okay, wow. And I'm talking about a period of 11 years, which was like that. And the first 7 years I spent whole day in retreat. So it was 12, 13 hours of practice per day, every day, every day, every day, without interruption. And he would come into those retreats and would sit down. He would come in. I had built a little blockhouse, and besides us, there were camping cars, and we were sitting in the forest and meditating. The toilet was outside in the forest, and no shower, just the host, you know. And he would come, and we would start explaining, asking our meditation experiences. We would talk, and then he would give answers to the experiences, like I'm doing with my students usually. And he was so relaxed. He was laughing his head off when we came with our experiences and then giving him pointers how to continue. Sometimes he laughed so much that he was sliding off the sofa, you know. And Vali was holding his knees so that he wouldn't fall down. It was like very much a living room experience, you know, like you would be sitting for a chat at the, you know, like in any place it could happen. Nothing very honorable and very, you know, like this. It was just a father talking to his children. That's the basic situation of transmission. I just wanted to mention that because that's the kind of background I come from.